I just want to feel something at this point.
Totally.
Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I am Adam.
And I'm Norm.
You did the contractions again. You guys leave me hanging with the contractions. I say I'm, and then you go with I am, and
I'm just going with
and I'm just out here.
That's fine. I don't think we're leaving you hanging. I think we're just exploring a meter. If you said I'm Will, and I said I'm Adam, that's a regular way of doing it. And I toyed this time with the idea of saying, Madam, I'm Adam, which is the first palindrome.
I think that's pretty good. Yeah. Learned. Yeah, that's not bad.
I have a collection of palindromes.
Really?
It's a big list Word document.
Yeah, I have 17,000 of them.
That is a lot of palindromes.
What's the longest?
Oh, the longest is too long to even repeat. It's
In terms of is it a full sentence? A paragraph?
Oh yeah, no, it's paragraphs. It's really long.
Wow. Is it nonsense or does it make? Is it?
It makes
a little
some
bit
sense. It's a very look. It makes some sense. You're giving them a big pass on sensibility because of
it's poetry. At some
that
point,
is crazy wind out there.
That is just wind. That's not a person knocking.
No, it's wind. I think that there should be a name for the poetry that arises from typos that come from touch keyboards that auto correct as you go and people who are bad at using them.
Well, I must have said this joke on this podcast before. Do you know how many Apple Newtons it takes to screw in a light bulb? Fruit bat.
That sounds about right.
Wow. And there was way back, someone actually used an Apple Newton to write the poem Jabberwocky.
Really?
And the title of the poem is Tablespoons, because that's as close as the Newton could get to Jabberwocky.
Well, so back in the day, I was a pretty accomplished Palm Pilot user. You know, I use a Palm 3, Palm 5. We use them for work. And once you got the knack of that Jot stuff that you used on, or whatever, I think it was called Jot, I can't remember, but it was almost like stenography. You had a specific set of, it was almost like courting, you made a symbol and it translated
that
and it was really fast.
I remember that language. It was easy to learn.
It wasn't as fast as typing with my thumbs now.
No.
But I think I was probably more accurate overall.
Right. Because A was an upside down V.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember.
Just removed ambiguity from basic characters.
Every letter was reduced to its critical line.
And there was no uppercase, lowercase distinction. You just swiped up beforehand to indicate that you wanted it uppercase. And I mean, it worked
pretty good.
Reasonably well.
It's like pager code for nerds.
Kind of. But then I also had a hardware keyboard. So when I needed to write a real email or something, I would just plug in the real keyboard and jam it out.
Right.
They went to keyboards with the Palm Pilot, and the whole thing went to hell.
Right. Well, and then you had the PDAs that could recognize cursive writing. And now no one can even write cursive writing.
No one can.
Do they teach that in school? Did your kids learn cursive?
Optional.
It is
really?
Optional. My kids' handwriting is semi-abysmal. But so is mine. I mean, I remember I was always put in the special class for crappy handwriting.
They're all time travelers.
And my dad had unbelievably beautiful handwriting. He was a real illustrator. And he said, you have to think of writing as drawing. And it took me years to understand that really what he meant by that was you have to like the act of writing. In the same way that you're careful with drawing because you want the line to depict something in the same way you are accurate with your writing. But of course, there's so much to write and it takes so long and I get so impatient and it ends up looking like a doctor's prescription. Yeah.
But I can do that infinitely fast.
And don't you get frustrated? Like, that's why people like, writing within the lines and having really beautiful calligraphy. Yeah, it's really pretty.
It is. It is absolutely gorgeous. And I'm a huge, I respect greatly lovely handwriting. It's funny, both my wife and I love each other's handwriting, but deride our own.
Huh.
Maybe that means we're meant for each other.
Yeah.
Lucky that.
Perfect compliment. Speaking of perfect compliments.
I had a really fun time this weekend.
Really?
I was in Connecticut with Chuck Klosterman.
Okay.
John Moe, who's the ethicist of the New York Times. Mm-hmm. John Moe,
Is he the ethicist or is he the...
He's the new ethicist. Randy Cohen is no longer.
Oh, okay. I thought he used to be the ombudsman or something, right?
I don't know. He's also an author. He's written a bunch of books.
He's an interviewer and
absolutely.
A person of note.
A person of note, a wonderful, wonderful mind. John Moe, who is the host of the awesome NPR show Wits, on which I have appeared singing as Gollum on the phone when Neil Gaiman called me up and asked me to...
Perfect.
Seeing as Gollum.
That's exactly right.
And then my very good friend, Aisha Tyler, the unbelievably awesome shockingly grounded, totally amazing Aisha Tyler.
She has large hands.
She has large hands?
Well, that's the joke on Archer.
Oh, right.
Her character has ridiculously oversized hands.
She's so awesome. And it's just great spending time with her.
What event brought all three of you together?
Four.
Nerdfest. Actually, it was the Connecticut Forum, which is a longtime discussion forum in Connecticut. Basically, they get smart people up on stage to discuss complex topics.
Huh.
And the audience shows up to watch that happen. And then we take questions from the audience.
Are these like college students? Are they just members
of
the community?
It's all over the map. Actually, there's over 700 members, I believe. I hope I'm right about this, of the Connecticut Forum. The youngest members are in grade school or in high school. We met a bunch of those kids. And the oldest are, you know, regular people, my age and even older. And they buy season tickets, or they buy tickets individually per event. And, you know, everything from watching people talk about medicine to music.
Politics. Like the Commonwealth Club.
Yeah, exactly. And except a much bigger audience. It's 2,500 people.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we were up there talking about nerds. And the question
was, like, being nerds or discussing, just look at that guy with that belt pulled up too
actually,
high.
Actually, it was the opposite of that. The question we were debating or discussing was, why do nerds rule the world?
Oh, smart or money, right? It's
well,
one of those two.
I mean, you know, in the end, it was fascinating. None of us, there's a rare and perfect grouping in that none of us had any kind of axe to grind or point to make. And we were all sort of open. And I think we all actually learned something in the course of the discussion. You know, I got some more clarity about the way I think about it. And you know, probably the main thing I got is nerd is now a popular term as opposed to a pejorative term.
When we were kids, if somebody called you a nerd or a geek or a dork, it usually was preceded by getting your underwear pulled up over your head.
Let me just describe to you a specific night. I'm in New York. I'm 19. I'm hanging out with my friend Davey, and our friend Ari calls, and Ari says, "Dudes," it's like 1 a.m.
Yeah.
"Dudes, it's Ari, man. I'm uptown at this insane party. It is all models. You have got to get up here." And we're like, "All right, let's gear up," because that's what you do when you're 19.
Yeah, yeah.
We take the subway uptown. We're on the Upper West Side. We walk into this apartment. There's like intense music happening. There's like a saxophonist in the middle of the living room riffing. And it's true.
This is what, like 1982?
No. This is 1986.
Okay.
And the apartment is packed, I'm not kidding, with models.
Okay.
They're all like 6.5 feet tall. And you know, their eye line is a plane.
Yeah.
And I am not in that plane, either physically, mentally, or in any other fashion.
It's the wrong decade for platform shoes.
Yes, exactly. And while we're there, we are like hanging out and we're like trying to fit in, and we totally don't fit in, the three of us. It is a John Hughes movie to film us against the background of this party. And a dude walks up to us and says, "Are you guys nerds?" And I was like, "Yeah, it's time for me to go."
And that's when the forced perspective zoom comes in. Somebody screams, "Nerds!"
Yeah,
and points
exactly.
And you're kicked out. Yeah.
And I bolted. It was a shameful moment, and I hated life at that moment. That's what nerd used to mean.
See, Norm,
I've never experienced
Norm
that.
He grew up in the Valley of the Nerds,
right?
Here.
Yes.
and it was a positive.
Yeah, man. It sucked for us back in those days.
It was not an easy time.
No. So we discussed.
You had to hide shit.
Now we talked to the kids, and when we were talking to the kids, we got to a point that we made also in front of the audience, which was the kids were asking us about challenges we'd had in our lives and ways we overcame them and ways we'd made choices and stuff. And we realized at a certain point, we said this, look, please understand, don't make the mistake of thinking that our lives, any of the four of us, our lives were in any way linear.
Yeah.
Nobody's life is linear. It looks linear when you write it out as a story. Like, oh, all these choices that Adam made led inexorably to having all the skills for a TV show. Man, I was not. My goals changed all the time, and they weren't linear goals. And it seems much more. Even Chris Hadfield, who knew he wanted to be an astronaut at the age of 9, says every time he gets in front of an audience, my life is not nearly as linear as it looks. And I think that's a really important thing. But more universal to get to the point of nerds is that we talked about the fact that really when you're talking about nerds or what you'd think of as a marginalized community, the trick is to remember that you might think that you're lonely and life is hard, but for other people it's easy. And the thing to that we're here to tell you as adults is everyone's life sucks.
Yeah, well,
the first noble truth of the Buddha holds true is everyone suffers and no one's having an easier time of it, even if it appears to you from the outside.
And it's just easier for those communities to find each other.
And now with the internet, that is exactly right. That's what has happened is those marginalized communities are not so marginalized when you go to Pinterest and find 55 other pre-1920 Zippo collectors.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, eBay started this, right? Yeah. eBay started this in the late 90s, mid-90s, when all of a sudden you realize, wait, somebody else collects whatever it is that is the weird thing that you like to collect.
Oh, man.
There is a market full of other people that are into collecting that exact same thing.
And you can go and find the $6 million man of your childhood dreams.
Yeah.
Your childhood is a fun activity.
I was actually the other night looking not only at $6 million man to find that all of the roll-up arm flesh on the old $6 million man's
it's all
rotted.
Gone, yeah.
But the one that I wanted was the Maskatron, which had Michael Ironside's face, Oscar Goldman.
I know that because of the 40-year-old virgin.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because he has the Oscar Goldman. It's actually much more valuable than the Steve Austin. There were very few of those, and it was new in box.
The Oscar
Please
Goldman Maskatron and the Steve Austin Maskatron.
Yeah.
That was really cool.
That's amazing.
Yeah, with the pop-out chips.
See, I know all of my $6 million man knowledge, much like my Buck Rogers knowledge, is from watching going to visit my grandparents in D.C. as a kid in the summer, and they had, instead of just the normal three channels, they had some other channels that just bought, like, pre-TBS kind of rerun channels. So they would buy old shows.
Wow.
And on weekday afternoons, instead of showing cartoons or whatever they used to show then, they would put on $6 Million Man and Buck Rogers.
That's far out. I didn't realize that.
Flash Gordon and stuff like that, like old serials. And
so if you want to make a lot of money now, you should start archiving all the stuff that kids love today. So when they want to reclaim their childhoods, you can sell it as a package.
So the thing that happened in the 70s and 80s is that all of the toys and all that stuff were kind of short run. There wasn't a lot of that.
Right.
People didn't realize it had any value and they threw it all out. And then when the initial Star Wars stuff hit and people realized that that first collection of what, like 12 action figures or whatever it was insanely valuable to collectors, that ruined the whole thing.
Do you know,
it's
done. I think I'm still right about this, that Fawn Davis actually owns a complete set of Star Wars figures.
Wow. Oh, this first series
of
all the way through.
Everyone that's ever, wow. At least as
Good
of
God,
10 years
man.
Ago, the last time I was in his, in his house, at that point, he had every Star Wars figure ever made.
That is a lot of Star Wars
figures. I mean, he
was
missing, you know, maybe like one of the early Boba Fett prototypes, which are like $15,000.
The ones that shoot that actually have the firing missile.
Exactly.
The eye blaster is what they call that one.
Yeah. But so the Connecticut Forum was really,
like
really fun.
Yeah, good event.
It was a great event.
Is it online someplace? Do you know?
I'm not sure. I know it was streamed. I believe it was streamed, which means it should be
probably
online. And I guess we'll take a look and
I'll see if we can track it down and we'll push on the site.
It was lovely to finally meet John Moe, who, you know, I've only met on the phone before. And Chuck Klosterman and I are fans of each other's work.
Cool.
He's a wonderful talker, wonderful thinker. And Aisha's just super awesome.
She's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll see her at Comic-Con.
Oh, good.
She'll be there.
Miracle. You'll be doing a Woodstock at Comic-Con.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. And by the time people listen to this, if they're in the Bay Area, you'll also be at Maker Faire.
I will also be at Maker Faire speaking on Sunday in the middle of the day. I'm not sure exactly which time, but Sunday in the middle of the day.
And there'll be details at Maker Faire. If you're at Maker Faire, there'll be details where you can find out where you'll be and when.
And we'll have
we'll have it on the site.
Yes.
Barring technical failures or disaster.
I have spoken at every Maker Faire since, I think, the second one.
Well, every Bay Area Maker Faire.
Every Bay
There's
Area.
There's a bunch of them. There are a ton of them now. There's like Kansas City.
But the Bay Area one is now like almost 200,000 people.
It's huge.
It's massive.
It's
sells
rivaling Comic-Con in the actual size.
Last year, we we usually get there a couple hours early so that we can, they'll sneak us in. We can walk around, kind of scout out where we want to shoot and set up times and stuff with people. And last year we were there and the main parking lot was already almost full by the time, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours before the gates opened on Saturday morning. It's bananas.
Crazy.
It's a great event. If you're anywhere near the Bay Area, I think it's like $30 a person. Kids get in cheaper.
And I ran into someone recently who asked me, oh, is it good for my 7 or 9 year old?
Yes.
And I was like, yes, go there.
Perfect age.
Yeah. Really, you will blow your children's minds. There's no age at which it's too young. Well, okay, like a toddler might not. No, there's still going to be unbelievable stuff for every age of kids.
As long as they can hold their own head up and focus at things more than 3 feet away, your kids are probably
as long as they can hold their head up, give them 2 20s and send them out to the hot dog stand. Should be fine.
Yeah, exactly. Stand.
So speaking of nerds and rage and fun and all that
toys
stuff
and merchandising.
So we talked about the new trilogy.
Yes.
A few, I guess last year, maybe the year before at this point,
J.J. Abrams directing
J.J. Yeah. The post George Lucas Star Wars trilogy.
Penning.
I'm so excited.
But since we last spoke about it, the casting.
Well, there were rumors and all that stuff. But they've announced the casting, and
the big reveal that we were all, I think, fairly confident of is that Harrison Ford, Carrie Fisher, and Mark Hamill are making a return, as well as Kenny Baker as R2-D2, Anthony Daniels as C-3PO, and I'm very pleased about this. Peter Mayhew as Chewbacca.
Who is at the reading?
Yes.
So they released
a picture of all of them, plus a new cast, including Adam Driver from Girls.
Yep.
Max von Sydow? No.
Yes, it is.
Max von Sydow.
He's not in the picture. He's the only one that's on the picture, but he is probably the villain.
Including R2-D2 in the crate, and I have personally packed R2-D2 into that crate.
Wow.
That is the crate.
Oh, that's the R2-D2
crate from ILM. It's actually Annie Leibovitz took some photos of R2 in that crate for Vanity Fair for one of the prequel.
Oh, that's awesome.
Vanity Fair issues.
Andy Serkis. In a role yet to be determined.
The thing that a lot of people fail to understand, because Andy Serkis is so amazing as a physical performer, and there's only a few people like that, like Doug Jones, who has been in a million movies as characters are very familiar with. Andy Serkis is, in addition to being an incredible physical performer, he played King Kong in King Kong, he played Gollum in The Lord of the Rings.
Caesar in
Planet of the Apes, both the previous one and the one that's just coming out. He's a brilliant actor. Whether or not he is a virtual character or Andy Serkis himself, he's a phenomenal, amazing actor who I would see in a movie. I'd see him on stage. I'd see him
on stage for sure. Yeah. He was in The Prestige. He played David Bowie's assistant, Tesla's assistant. So there's been some
Inkheart. He's in Inkheart with Brendan Fraser as the villain, and he's terrific in that. It's not that awesome a movie, but
but the performance. So these actors are there, and there's a bunch of a new cast of young actors.
Yes.
You mentioned
Adam Driver,
and the guy from Drive.
Oscar Isaac,
and Inside Llewyn Davis.
Yes.
He's fantastic in that.
Let me also say about Adam Llewyn Driver. Davis, I've read a lot of stuff about Adam Driver, and people are like, really? The dude from Girls is in Star Wars?
Oh, he's so good, though.
Well, not only is he really great in Girls, but lest you think that that's all he can do, go watch him in Francis Ha, which is, by the way, freaking insanely great.
Is
Noah Baumbach's new film with Greta Gerwig. Mm-hmm. They wrote it together. It's beautiful. And frankly, having kind of growing up in New York, there's a perfect depiction of the total self-centeredness of the early 20s and growing up in New York. But Adam Driver has a bit part in it, and he is totally different than his character in Girls and really excellent. Oh. So I think he's a wonderful actor.
Wonderful. I mean, there's the speculation now is exactly who these people may be playing.
Right.
And there was some analysis and it's fun to ponder and analyze the one photo.
Yes.
You see, there was that story picking out the seating arrangements and
Is there something to it? Are these the Sith?
Exactly.
The guys? You know, they have to be, when they staged that photo, somebody.
Well, they said not staged.
Okay. When J.J. Abrams is looking at the way they're arrayed, he has to be thinking, oh, we can probably fuck with people a lot if we just make Adam sit next to so-and-so and, you know.
So, IO9, I think, had this story. And they said it's true in past when you do these first reads, like script reads, you kind of pair the people who are going to be in conversation with one another closer to each other.
Yeah.
Because you can have movies where two leads rarely encounter another. So there is an actress sitting between Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher. And so the speculation is this young actress going to play their daughter?
Right. Oh yeah.
And just based on that assumption, then they propagate like how you could have all the other relationships in the movie.
Daisy Han Ridley, Solo, I think, right?
I don't even care about anybody else. I can barely contain my excitement that Han Solo is in this movie.
Yeah, thank God he said yes.
What's that? Because
he could have said no.
I know. But I mean, it's hard to overestimate Harrison Ford's importance as a screen star. Within the latter 20th century history of cinema. I mean, you can't overstate it. And the fact is he's played very different characters with very different personalities and beautifully in ways that you really feel like you know them. And Han Solo is without a doubt one of my favorite both characters and conventions in that in a movie that really could be, look, Star Wars could have been as plodding and silly as Episode One, except for the fact that Han Solo is making fun of the movie while he's in it. He's making fun of all the conventions of the film while he's in
it. But that's the thing that, like, I don't think I'd seen. I mean, obviously I hadn't seen it before because it was two.
Yeah.
But going back and watching films that are older than Star Wars, I hadn't seen the wink and the nod that, for example, Joss Whedon applied with wonderful effect in The Avengers.
Yes.
And, you know, that started with, I think, Star Wars, probably. Maybe Jaws. Because
The question is whether that's going to be the same characterization that he has in this new movie, which would be a little weird for
Han Solo. It's 30 years later.
He should have matured.
So he's no longer going to necessarily be a charming rogue. But look at Super 8, right? Yeah. It is such an homage to E.T., and I'm one of the people who thinks it's actually a beautiful homage. I don't think it's just straight copying. I mean, granted, you have kids racing on bicycles towards the end, just like E.T., but it's a beautiful homage.
But how do kids get around?
Right. And frankly, you know, Coppola says he was just quoting early cinema when he made Godfather. He's just, you know, doing his... He is also picking up, just like Tarantino does, the conventions that he grew up with. So Abrams is deeply inculcated with the cinematic conventions of Lucas and Spielberg. And I think it's hard to discount Spielberg's influence on Star Wars as Lucas moved through the series and on cinema as the blockbuster movie came to be in the early 80s.
Yeah.
But sorry, I just want to finish this.
Yeah.
Thought is that he's absolutely going to give Han Solo the charming rogue bit that will take this movie and shift the plot to a certain point. I know that about Abrams. He's been dying to write for Han
Dad Solo
his whole life for that.
Yeah. Well, who says, and you know, Adam Driver could be Han Solo's kid too.
Could be.
Right?
Could be.
I mean, there's
He could be. People are like, oh, he make a good Sith. I mean,
just because he has dark hair and white, light skin doesn't mean he has
kind of weird.
He doesn't have any weird horns or anything.
It's so funny when I read all that speculation. I understand the excitement and the desire to speculate. I look at that and I think, oh, cool. Eventually I'll find out what those people are doing.
I mean,
and then I literally move my brain to the next thing.
And that's where I went through we've done this before.
Yeah.
We have walked this path before. And we all know how that ended up.
It's not going to be like that.
It's what?
It's not going to be like Episode One.
No,
walk
not
that
at all.
Path.
But I mean, I'm just saying we've walked the path, the casting, the hype, all of the building of the excitement, culminating with me sitting in a line for 12 hours waiting to get into the movie at midnight.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm okay not doing that again. I've been there.
Right.
I'm going to go in. You know, I find, especially now, the more hyped a movie is, the more I go in cold to that first showing, the happier I'm going to be. Because I don't have any preconceived notions. Yep. I can just go in and enjoy myself and have fun and watch a movie. And whether that's Transformers with the dinosaurs or the next Star Wars movie or the third Star Trek movie or what, I'm happy.
Is there dinosaurs in the new Transformers
movie? The new Transformers movie has the
spoilers.
Dinosaurs. Oh. It was in the Super Bowl trailer.
So, avoid all trailers.
Actually, speaking of not knowing anything before you go into a movie, can we segue here to, have you guys seen The Winter Soldier yet?
Oh, yes.
Oh, we didn't know if you'd seen it.
Oh, holy cow, what a great movie.
Okay, hold on. Are we going to spoiler cast from this point forward?
Let's do a spoiler cast from this point forward.
Oh, my goodness.
We'll talk about it for...
Oh, I'm so excited. I
saw it twice.
I'm going to see it again. I'm going to take my kids to see it. I got to take my wife to see it. It's just, it's really, really, it's, you know what? It loves you, right? It's got a good heart, and it doesn't want to put anything over on you.
I think it's amazing to me because last cycle with the leading up to the Avengers, with the first Captain America, the first Thor, and the second Iron Man, I thought Captain America and Thor were both better than the Iron. I mean, obviously they're better than the Iron Man. Right. This time it's happened again. Both the Thor movie and the Captain America movie are both better than Iron Man 3.
See, I thought the first Thor, even though I've seen it a couple times, I think it's real. I think it's really trashy.
It's
really
a little low budget.
It's super low budget. But the second Thor movie is genuinely enjoyable.
Yeah.
Really surprisingly fun.
Yeah.
But this Captain America film,
it's great.
Chris Evans is so good. And so genuine. He and Scarlett Johansson have a bunch of some complicated things to act out.
They're driving in the car and they have a scene about, you know, his first kiss.
Yeah.
They really play the man out of time, and they cut the scenes out of the Avengers. They had some extended scenes where he was dealing with the death of his friends, and they cut that out because they wanted him to deal with that in his own movie.
And
going back and visiting the love interest from the first movie.
Going back to visit, great. That was so heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
Really,
she like recognizes him again.
I could do without the actual Winter Soldier thing of like, it's your best buddy. That whole bit just struck me as like,
And did you know that going into the movie?
No.
And a lot of people, both times I watched it, a lot of the people who don't read comics, it was a genuine surprise. And I thought they did a good job with the Smithsonian having the exhibit.
Right.
Kind of remind people of that character.
It was a very really not heavy-handed way. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that sort of effortless exposition.
It doesn't
feel like it's being pounded into your
head. I've heard people say that it's like the twist. It's a great modern twist.
Yeah.
See, I knew that the Winter Soldier was Bucky Barnes, and I'm not a comic, like I'm the lightest of light comic book readers.
Yeah, I didn't know.
But I thought that the villain was, I thought he was the worst part of the movie. Like not through any fault of his own.
Yeah.
He was just kind of a one note villain without the Bucky Barnes connection.
Yeah. It wasn't that interesting. A villainy.
But the interesting thing was everything else that happened around that, the downfall of S.H.I.E.L.D., the commentary on our surveillance state.
So big spoiler, when Nick Fury dies, I turned to my friend and we both laughed because I was like, we're seeing him in Act 3.
Everybody knew.
I mean, or the Avengers 2, right?
Exactly.
He's coming back. That was a great car chase scene also.
Oh, Sam Jackson and the supercar?
Oh, dude.
Yes.
Really great.
They got Robert Redford to say Hail Hydra, which, wow, things you never thought that Robert Redford would ever say in a movie.
Well, and they did, you watched that movie and you saw the narrative points in the future as you're watching. There were no surprises in the third act of that movie, right? No. When you saw those three helicarriers, you're like, well, that's going to be bad for somebody. This is clearly not the way for the future of humanity. But it was so well put together.
Well,
and it was a very pleasant movie for me.
So I'm going to also go back to a convention that I think about action movies, which is one of the things I didn't like about Thor is Thor started out, the original Thor, with way too much ridiculous exposition. Right. Literally like, oh, there's an anomaly. Quick, drive to it. I didn't give up 4 college credits for everyone. Yeah. Every character is literally like dots on a line explicating who they are and how they feel about the situation. It feels so formulaic and exhausted. Whereas Winter Soldier, first 20 lines, which carries you like probably 15 minutes into the movie. The first 20 lines, all of them are great. All of them.
It starts with a secret mission or something.
Yeah.
Right?
It starts with the run between him and Falcon. And
he didn't jump. Did he have a parachute?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, he didn't.
Yeah.
What about that nurse and the thing? I don't know about that. You know, the dialogue between him and Scarlett Johansson, Black Widow, all of it. pithy, sweet, funny,
sets you up,
yeah. But you don't feel like you're being set up. That's the trick with exposition.
Yeah.
I don't want to know that you're telling me, like, I mean, my favorite is the opening line of Lawnmower Man, which is, "Don't you understand, man? If I give the serum to those monkeys, there's no telling what will happen." It's like, really, couldn't you, like, buy me dinner first? Like,
yeah. We don't have to... Well, but so it sets that up really well. It wasn't so action-y as to be exhausting.
No.
Like, by the end of Iron Man 3, I just wanted to take a nap because I'd seen, like, 65 robot suits beat the shit out of each other.
Well,
and I was good. And, like, I had all I needed.
And Winter Soldier has a couple of really nice, graceful pauses in the film where things slow way down. And, you know, my favorite example of that is... a great movie, Midnight Run, with Charles Grodin and Robert De Niro, mm-hmm. which, if you haven't seen it, one of the great road comedies of all time. And it includes in the middle, I won't spoil it, it includes in the middle a movie-stopping sequence of Robert De Niro's character confronting his past that totally has nothing to do with the plot of the movie and is magically perfectly placed to kind of pull you out of the plot and then put you back.
It's like a little one act play in the middle of the film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And those moments of pause really allow you to, again, fall in love with the character. So you're more invested to the end.
I
so excited.
Yeah. The scene in the middle where Scarlett Johansson and Chris Evans go to his training grounds and they find the Hydra scientists in the computer. And it's amazing. It's great.
The fight scenes were also very well shot. You could actually see what was going on.
That freeway fight.
The credit?
No.
The second unit director was also the fight coordinator, which is, I can't remember his name, but I saw that and I was like, that's why those fight scenes were so good.
Yeah.
He was both directing them and choreographing them. They really had, I mean, I like to point out, Michael Bay is a classic director who, you have no idea where you are in physical space through most of a Michael Bay film.
Yeah.
It's just cut, 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 cut.
It's like
action's
MTV.
Happening and here we go.
And he uses slow motion as a way to try to explain the action.
Right. Whereas with a director like Jon Favreau, you always know where you are in physical space with Jon Favreau. He's a very hands-on director who wants to put you in physical space. And Winter Soldier, all those fight sequences, I think are great because you understand where everyone is as stuff is happening.
And those are complex environments.
Yes.
They're talking about in terms of the highway and cars,
well, there's
a chase scene going on at the same time.
Whedon does that beautifully in Avengers. Again, you're fighting across all of New York, and you never feel like you don't know where everyone is.
It's only a 4-square block radius. It's very small, actually.
You've talked to the guys.
They didn't kill that many people, Adam. It's okay.
It was also really cool. The Winter Soldier, which is clearly a build-up to the next one of the Avengers movies or the third Captain America movie, just his makeup on the arm, the bionic arm, was really using new special effects techniques.
Really?
Also, in
was
terms
it?
Of the
it
the,
wasn't just CG.
It wasn't no practical arm.
Really?
For many of the shots, and it was lightweight, and the way they chromed it was
so,
all new.
You know, it's funny because I don't know if did Legacy Effects do
it was yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Because when I visited the set of Pacific Rim, the incomparable and my hero, Shane Mann, who's one of the key Stan Winston people for decades and is not only an incredible draftsman and designer, but also maker extraordinaire. He did all the exosuits for the characters in
for the pilots.
Rim. And I got a tour of the armor trailer.
Mm-hmm.
So this full trailer of, like, you know, 75 suits of armor that Legacy had built. And I walked in and I went, how did you chrome flexible rubber? And Shane went, someone who asks the right questions. They have built some amazing techniques in that shot.
It looks so
metalized. I thought it was CG. It's great.
It's a prosthetic.
How did they get the actor to let him cut his arm off? That's the question I had. So, I mean, here's, to tie this all back to Star Wars, the Disney owns Marvel and has done a wonderful job with the bits of the franchise that they own.
And letting great people helm the stuff, like letting Joss Whedon run the Marvel universe and putting great directors in charge of the individual films.
Let's be clear. They are doing this so they make a shitload of money on it. There is no doubt. But it seems like someone at least appreciates that the best way to make a lot of money with that and make it last forever is to keep the quality level very high and keep you know, keep producing stuff that people are excited about and want to see rather than just shoveling out the latest dreck. So I'm really optimistic that we see a Star Wars universe that is fleshed out in the same way where we see the you know, I don't think they'll do exactly the same thing where we see, you know, constant, you know, a 3-year cycle between main movies with some side projects on the side. But I wouldn't be averse to seeing interesting characters in Star Wars get their own movies and have the opportunity to tell their own stories.
Totally agree.
Which they're doing. Yeah, I'm excited about
it. That's a nice way to tie it together.
Yeah.
I think we should wrap it up.
I think that's a good time. We'll be back next week with more Still Untitled. As always, thanks for watching. Like us on YouTube. Rate us on iTunes.
Yes.
If you want to know about subscribing to Tested, then you can go to tested.com/premium. And we'll see you guys next week.
Bye, guys.
Bye.